Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is October 19th, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Sometimes All You Need Is the Air That You Breathe. And once again, I've confirmed I have no musical talent, but I do want to thank Kirsty Chowin for the theme music suggestion. Now, this week's guest skeptic is Marcus Prescott. Marcus is a nurse in Norway, and he is also now a first-year medical student. Welcome back to the SGEM, Marcus.
Thanks, Ken. It's nice to be back. Been too long.
It has been too long, but did you know, Marcus, you hold the record for the longest paper that I've ever had to read and review on the SGEM. It was way back in 2014, and it was episode number 98 called Don't Stand So Close to Me.
Yeah, that was the Cochrane review and meta-analysis on neuraminidase inhibitors for the flu. Over 500 pages, and I think it took 2 or 3 months to read through.
Well, if I recall correctly, we were not too impressed with the efficacy, or should I say the lack of efficacy of those drugs.
No, and we're not, or I at least am not now either. I've seen that there have been a few more studies, but they haven't been particularly impressive, mainly population level and a few RCTs.
Well, a lot has happened in your life in the last 3 years. You are now in medical school after working as a nurse. Why the change in career?
Well, it's mainly because I'm curious, I think. I like to learn more, and I didn't get into anesthetist school for 2 years running, and a friend pointed out you could just become an anesthesiologist instead. So I started med school.
And here you go. Is it 4 years there for medical school?
Six.
Oh, 6 years. Oh,
seven.
This is a big commitment after doing nursing for a while. A big commitment. Well, good for you. How about you give us a case, though? Let's start this podcast. Let's get into it clinically.
Yeah, sure. So in our case, we've got a 68-year-old man with a history of hypertension and dyslipidemia who develops chest pain while shopping. Now, emergency medical services are called and arrive quickly and find a man with a 7 out of 10 chest pain, vitals of, heart rate 72 beats per minute, blood pressure 150 over 90, respiratory rate of 14 breaths per minute, and an O2 sat of 93%. The EKG shows an inferior ST elevated myocardial infarction, or a STEMI. They give him 180 milligrams of ASA and package him for transportation to the hospital. While preparing to depart, they wonder if they should provide him with supplemental oxygen.
Well, oxygen is a drug and, like all other drugs, can have potential benefits and potential harms depending on how and when it is used. Studies have shown that oxygen can cause vasoconstriction, increased blood pressure, and decrease coronary artery blood flow.
A systematic review from 2009 found only 2 randomized controlled trials looking at supplemental oxygen, and one study of 200 patients demonstrated increased mortality, 4% in the controls and 11% in the oxygen treatment groups.
And then the second smaller study that was included in that systematic review had 50 patients, but it did not look at mortality, but it did show less ventricular tachycardia, or VTAC, with supplemental oxygen. Now, what would you rather have? More death with oxygen or less VT with oxygen?
Yeah. So oxygen supplementation has been a bit of a hot topic the last couple of years after the publication of the AVOID trial in 2014. So the AVOID trial showed no benefit and possible harm of high flow oxygen supplementation for AMIs if they had an O2 sat of over 94%. And if we look at the conclusion from that study, they said that supplemental oxygen therapy in patients with ST elevation myocardial infarction, but without hypoxia, may increase early myocardial injury and was associated with larger myocardial infarct sizes assessed at 6 months.
A 2016 Cochrane review by Cabello et al. Found 5 randomized control trials in patients with suspected or confirmed acute myocardial infarctions. And they found, quote, there is no evidence from randomized controlled trials to support the routine use of inhaled oxygen in people with AMI, and we cannot rule out a harmful effect, End of quote.
The Cochrane authors said that a well-designed RCT was needed due to uncertainty of routinely using supplemental oxygen. The European Conference of Cardiologists also asked for exactly that study, and exactly the study that has been published now.
Well, the AHA, the American Heart Association guidelines, were updated in 2015 and did not provide a strong recommendation on the issue. They say supplemental oxygen may be withheld in normoxic patients with suspected or confirmed acute coronary syndrome. So what's the clinical question?
Well, the clinical question is, does routine administration of supplemental oxygen in patients with suspected or confirmed acute myocardial infarctions who are not hypoxic provide a patient-oriented benefit?
And what's the reference?
The reference is the Hoffman et al. Oxygen therapy in suspected acute myocardial infarction. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in September 2017.
All right, let's run through that PICO, Marcus. Can you give us the population?
The population were patients of 30 years or older with symptoms suggestive of myocardial infarctions for less than 6 hours. Oxygen saturation is greater than 89%. And either evidence of ischemia on the ECG or elevated cardiac troponins on admission.
And they did have some exclusions. They excluded patients in cardiac arrest, oxygen saturations less than 90%, or who received ongoing oxygen therapy.
Yeah, and the intervention, was the supplemental oxygen at 6 liters per minute for 6 to 12 hours through open face mask.
And what did they compare it to?
They compared it to ambient air, which we'll get back to.
What was their primary outcome?
The primary outcome was very patient-oriented. It was simply death from any cause within 1 year.
And how about secondary outcomes?
The secondary outcome was death of any cause within 30 days, rehospitalization for MIs or heart failure, and cardiovascular death, as well as composite endpoints at 30 days and 1 year.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, routine use of supplemental oxygen in patients with suspected myocardial infarction who did not have hypoxemia was not found to reduce 1 year all-cause mortality, end of quote. All right, let's run through the 11 questions for randomized clinical trials. Question number one is, the study population, did it include or focused on those in the emergency department?
No, it didn't.
And how about the patients? Were they adequately randomized?
It seems so. Yeah.
Did they conceal the randomization?
They did.
And were they analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes.
How about consecutive recruitment?
I'm not quite sure about that one. It wasn't explicitly mentioned.
Were both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes.
Were all participants unaware of group allocation?
No.
So were all groups treated equally except for the intervention, and in this case, supplemental oxygen?
No, they weren't.
And how about the follow-up? Was it complete?
It was complete, impressively so, actually.
And did they consider all of the patient important outcomes?
No.
And the last question, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No.
All right, let's go through those key results. There were close to 7,000 patients included in the study for the intention to treat analysis. Now, about two-thirds arrived by ambulance. The median age was 68 years, and slightly more than two-thirds of the patients were male. Patients were on oxygen therapy for a median duration of almost 12 hours. In addition, the supplemental oxygen did result in a statistically significant increase in oxygen saturation. But Marcus, what about that primary outcome?
For the primary outcome, they found no difference in death from any cause within 1 year.
That's right. The primary outcome of death of any cause at 1 year was 5.1% versus 5%.
Yeah, and they also did a per-protocol analysis of the data and, again, found no difference in mortality. And what's interesting when you have these huge numbers is that you can do some good subgroup analyses, and they found that the result was consistent over all subgroups.
How about those secondary outcomes that you mentioned earlier through the PICO?
Yeah, they found no difference in death from any cause at 30 days, rehospitalization with AMIs at 30 days, rehospitalization with AMIs at 1 year. And unfortunately, because of lag time in the heart failure data, they were unable to come up with any conclusions on that.
Well, that's it for the key results. Marcus, talk nerdy to me.
So, of course, five being your favorite number, Ken, we've come up with 5 points. The first one was about consecutive emergency department patients. So we're not actually sure whether the patients were recruited consecutively. It wasn't explicitly stated in the study, and this could introduce selection bias. Also, of course, they recruited patients from ambulance services, EDs, coronary care units, cath labs, but you know, 2/3 of the patients came by ambulance. So this is quite similar to the chest pain population that we actually see. And also these relatively broad inclusion criteria might increase the validity of these results in other clinical settings. So you can't just use the data in the ED. You might actually have use of it in the cath lab or wherever.
The second issue was about blinding. This was an open label trial, not a double blinded trial. They said it was not feasible or ethical to have a sham comparison group. However, this lack of blinding should have favored the treatment group. This actually strengthens our confidence in the result not demonstrating benefit of supplemental oxygen.
Yeah, and the third point we have is whether the patients were treated equally. We were quite unsure whether the patients were treated equally. This is because it's a pragmatic study design and physicians decided any treatments to use outside of the protocol. Table 2 in the article reports management was the same, except for some inotropes being used more in the oxygen group. Also, there might be some unmeasured confounders here. In addition, the physician could provide supplemental oxygen to a patient based on clinical necessity. So this happened quite a bit more in the ambient air group with 8% than the oxygen group with 2%, making the data a little difficult to interpret.
The fourth point was about the power of the study. This study ended up being underpowered for the primary outcome. They had based their power calculation on estimated one-year total mortality of 14.4% among patients with myocardial infarctions. Now, death from any cause at 1 year, you'll remember, was 5%. They provided three possible explanations for the lower observed mortality. Sicker patients were excluded, so if the patients were hypoxic and those with altered mental status, and healthier patients were included, with a quarter having a diagnosis other than an acute myocardial infarction. This means that there still could be a statistical difference between the two groups, if the study had enough patients enrolled. In other words, a type 2 error could be made by concluding that there is no difference between the two groups, when in fact, there is a difference.
Yeah, and that leads us nicely into the fifth point, clinical versus statistical significance. So, say they actually had a well enough powered study. Even if there was a statistical difference, you have to wonder whether it actually matters. So say you've got an 0.1, 0.2% difference in mortality, but you don't actually have a difference in a neurological function or in people surviving with good neurologic function. Does that actually matter? Is it clinically significant?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point because we said that, you know, mortality was a very patient-oriented outcome, and I agree, and it's a really hard outcome. They're not mostly dead. And that's what we're trying to avoid. So even if they found a statistical difference and they had more people survive mostly dead, that's not a good outcome if they're not neurologically intact, if they can't have a good life after. We just don't want to be saving more and more people who are neurologically damaged. So I think that was a great fifth point that you brought in there about the difference between clinical and statistical significance. But let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEMs.
Well, generally, we agree with the authors. As mentioned, the few things that could have been done differently or maybe even better, but no reason to doubt the main conclusion.
All right, how about an SGEM bottom line?
Yeah, so routine administration of supplemental oxygen in patients with suspected or confirmed acute myocardial infarctions who are not hypoxic does not appear to provide a patient-oriented benefit.
Can you resolve that case that you presented of the 68-year-old man who presented with an O2 sat of 93% after experiencing chest pain in the grocery store while shopping?
Sure. So the patient was not hypoxic with an O2 sat of 93%. So the paramedics can load him up into the ambulance and head to the hospital, notifying them that they've got an inferior STEMI on the way.
All right. How about taking this paper and clinically applying it?
This study really answers the questions that the Cochrane reviewers and different committees and conferences have been asking, and it doesn't demonstrate the benefit of supplemental oxygen in these patients. Now, as such, my department has actually already changed its protocol, and I know that the European Conference of Cardiologists last month changed their guidelines.
Yeah, well, at our place, we still have patients being provided supplemental oxygen. So I plan to go talk with my EMS director about changing their protocols to administer oxygen to patients routinely with suspected or acute confirmed MIs who are hypoxic only.
And that's, of course, the central point there. If a patient is actually hypoxic, you give them oxygen, obviously. But
if they're not, you don't need to. All right, so what are you going to tell this patient that busy shopping in the grocery store experiencing chest pain?
It does look like you're having a heart attack, and we've given you aspirin. We'll take you quickly and safely, hopefully, to a hospital. That can treat your heart attack. Your vital signs are looking good, and we'll keep monitoring them on the way to the hospital. Now, specifically, your oxygen level is looking fine, and we don't need to give you any extra oxygen.
All right, well, it's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Dr. Drew Waters, a clinical assistant professor of medicine at Indiana University School of Medicine, but currently working in New Zealand. Drew knew that it was Gabe Merkin who coined the mnemonic RICE back in 1978. Were you even born then, Marcus?
I was not.
So this mnemonic stood for rest, ice, compression, and elevation. And it should be noted that he has since recanted his support for the RICE regimen. Now, before we go on, though, you wanted to comment on a previous Keener question about the discovery of oxygen. Marcus, what did you have to say on that?
Well, it was about whether Priestley actually discovered oxygen. Now, there's no discussion that he has priority when it comes to publication. He was the first person who published the discovery of oxygen. However, 2 or 3 years earlier, there was a Swede called William Scheele who actually discovered oxygen. Now, Isaac Asimov called him Hard Luck Scheele because I think he discovered 8 or 9 elements without getting credit for a single one of them. He really demonstrates the idea that for discoveries in science, first people deny it's real, then they deny it's important, and then they give credit to the wrong person.
And that's the way it often is with science. It's messy, it's complicated, and often it's that first person who publishes gets the credit for the discovery.
Yeah, and you'd also get a lot further by not publishing in Swedish.
Well, what question do you have for us this week?
The question this week is, what percentage of the Earth's atmosphere is made of oxygen?
Yeah, and that gets back to our PICO, because in the PICO, the comparator was ambient air. So what percentage of Earth's atmosphere is actually made of oxygen? What would these people be breathing in if they were only breathing in ambient air as the comparison to the supplemental oxygen? Well, if you know the answer to this week's Keener question, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize.
If I know the answer, can I send an email?
No, you may not. But you will get a cool skeptical prize as the guest skeptic. And so all the guest skeptics, so if you're wondering, I haven't been able to win the cool skeptical prize, you can get a cool skeptical prize by actually being the guest skeptic. Okay, S-Gemmers, remember, ASAP is coming up at the end of the month. I'll be in Washington, D.C. to debate Captain Cranium himself, Chris Carpenter, at the rural section meeting on October 29th between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Please come by and watch the guy in the ivory tower sweat when facing a rural ace. Yes, that's a rural academic center of excellence. Or if you just see me in the hallway, stop and say hello. There are some other FOMED resources on this issue of supplemental oxygen, and I will put them in the show notes. Marcus, thanks for coming back and picking a much shorter paper.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought we couldn't torture you every time, but next time I'll bring something longer.
Oh, thank you. And good luck with medical school.
Oh, thanks. I'll need it.
And can you give the SGEM tagline, but in Norwegian?
Sure, I'll try. Husk å være skeptisk til alt du lærer, selv om du har hørt det på Skeptikernes guide til akuttmedisin.
Talk to everyone next time.